Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really awesome founder, you know, a founder from Mexico, actually, you know, that he's done a lot of good stuff. You know, he's been an angel for quite a bit. And now he's riding this rocket ship that we're going to be talking about. But again, brace yourself for talking about storytelling, talking about how to master your numbers, how to enter a space that you have no idea, you know, what's it about, and having that humility. And again, tremendous story that we have ahead of us. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Manolo Atala. Welcome to the show.
Hello, man. Thank you very much, Alex. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here, man.
So it's our honor to have you with us. So give us a walk through memory lane, because you were born in Mexico and raised there. So how was life growing up for you?
Well, it was pretty regular, pretty common. I really like Mexico City. I was born and raised here. I've never, you know, lived in any other city or country, even though that I've been traveling a lot in the last probably 20 years. I've been always here.
I mean, the ecosystem of Mexico, you know, is just incredible. I know that for you, you know, especially something that has helped you as a founder, you know, later on, and perhaps also at helping other founders there in the region, is storytelling. At what point, you know, would you say that you really understood, you know, the importance of storytelling and ultimately how that combined with trust, you know, could be magical?
That's an amazing question. Actually, for me, storytelling, it's extremely important throughout your career. In general, you don't need to be a founder. You need storytelling for a lot of stuff, even though you're, I don't know, part of a corporate business, a big corporation or whatever you are trying to say, storytelling, it's very, very important. So, for me, you know, knowing how to effectively sell yourself and what you are trying to accomplish by aligning your words with your actions, that creates trust. You know, you need to be very, very careful with what you are saying and doing, because trust is the most important asset you need to have. As an entrepreneur, you know, you need to have a lot of very good reputation in the market, because, you know, that's the way you're going to fundraise and do a lot of things. A lot of people are going to, you know, willing to jump into your company to follow your vision because they trust you or your reputation. So the storytelling and the narrative you gave to the market and outside, you know, publicly, it's very, very, very important. So don't underestimate that.
I hear you on that. I mean, without trust, nothing else matters, right? So, I mean, trust is really the fundamental building block to any type of relationship. Now, I think in your case, you know, too, is 21. 21 is when the venture world started knocking on your door. I mean, how did that happen? That's quite early.
Yes. So that was the first time that at that age, I started my first business. It was an advertising business that I saw in UK back in the 2000. And basically I just jumped from, you know, studying and doing, you know, university. I was a dropout. I'm going to be extremely clear with you. I was not a dropout. They actually expelled me from the university for bad behavior. And I decided, okay, if I can study because I was expelled from the university, I'm going to run a business. I'm going to launch a business. So I just started that. And that was like that activated something in my head, in my mind, that I can't do this. Even though that it was not a great business or that I needed to shut it down, the business, that created this first spark in my head saying, okay, I can do this. I can do it again and again till I succeed, right? So that was very important in my career.
I mean, you did it a few times, you know, before you went at it with music full time. You know, because right before music, you were also on the creative side with a video production company, which is not so sexy as perhaps what you're doing today. But full-time music, I guess one of the things that music gives you, it reminds me, you know, to what Steve Jobs said, that he would love to hire engineers that have a music background for whatever reason. You know, I think it gives you an edge. But I guess What, tell us about this music, you know, side of you, that that chapter two in your life, and how do you think it helps you to see things differently?
I think that I enjoyed that stage of my life a lot, because it gave me like room, like brain space to think about like what I wanted for the future. But at the same time, it shaped my head mathematically. You know, it's like interesting because music, it's equals to math. And I love numbers and I love to crunch numbers. And to be able to learn music as fast as I needed, because I got into a band that it was already, you know, created and they already have songs. And I didn't know how to play an instrument. So I needed to actually learn extremely fast. And that shaped your head very differently and very creatively. So that those two elements helped me down the road in my career. Like probably 15 years after, I see now that, you know, music helped me creatively and mathematically in my career. How I see numbers, how I, you know, design numbers in my head, it was because of the music.
So one thing here that is incredible is you got a taste of entrepreneurship. You got a taste of, you know, having your own destiny at your fingertips and having control over that. And then all of a sudden, after your music stint, you go at it with joining the corporate world. I mean, that's quite the switch.
I needed cash. I needed, you know, a paycheck. So actually, it was very funny because when I was doing like full-time music or musician, full-time job, I remember perfectly going like, you know, from bar to bar asking for a job, like, you know, in the door or in the bar or whatever, like a waiter position, whatever. I just needed like some cash to survive, right? So I remember looking for jobs at that moment. And I said like, hey, this is unsustainable. My personality asks for more. Like I'm a very ambitious person. And I said, like, is that going to be sustainable to be a musician full time or to ask for these kind of jobs? So I need to go to the corporate world and you know, to maximize my skill set. Even though that I didn't have a career, I needed to maximize my skill set in order for me to have a paycheck and then do whatever I wanted. That was the first like thought that I had back in 2004, 2003.
Well, one thing that led, you know, one thing led to the next, and you ended up launching their Groupon in Mexico. You know, one thing that really gave you a superpower, which I think it really serves a lot, you know, which is understanding people's motivations and ultimately how you can use that in order to hire the best. So tell us about this experience of Groupon, you know, launching that, going through that journey, and then also really learning about people.
Okay, so I then, after this entertainment company, I went to Yahoo for the sales team. I was a sales manager in Yahoo in 2000, I think, 2008 or 2009. And I had a two people team. Like it was, we're just a three people team, and it was very efficient. It was very clear who needed to do what, the responsibilities and everything. And then suddenly I went from Yahoo to Groupon, to launching Groupon in 2010. You know, my needs, my people needs were for around 150 people. So I then started to hire like, you know, like crazy at the very beginning when we launched. And then I needed to learn how to do that, because if you want to create a successful business, it's impossible to do it alone. There's a lot of people that think that, oh, I'm, you know, smart enough or I'm capable enough to build this on my own, and I'm just going to have like, you know, these second class employees that are going to be doing the operational thing. You can't do that. You know, you need very talented people in every position in order for you to succeed. You know, it's very arrogant to think that you're going to be doing everything, or at least the smart moves in the business or the strategic moves in the business. You need a very talented team. So learning how to navigate through, you know, through different teams, personalities. You need to be a psychologist sometimes. You need to be a leader some others. You need to sell yourself to people, you know. You need to sell your position to the company or to the employees or to your, you know, to your peers or whatever. So I think that one of the most important things in the entrepreneurship, as I see it myself, and as I live through that, it's how to be a leader, how to understand people's motivations, people's skill sets, to understand people's behavior. In order for you to succeed, you need to understand all these dynamics so you can be a good leader in order for you to succeed. So I don't want to repeat myself anymore, but you know, I learned that with Groupon, with, you know, hiring from 0 to 150 people and to create a $30 million revenue company in the first year. So it was very hard.
That's unbelievable. Now one thing that you did is you went from the, you know, basically the operator side at a large structure like that to then, you know, helping on perhaps, you know, companies they're launching in Latin America, which I think it gave you a good sense of the region and the development, the crazy growth, you know, of the region, which it's incredible, you know, what Mexico and all of the other Latin American countries have experienced, whether it's, you know, companies launching or venture capital firms going there to make investments. But you definitely, you know, like got going with that. And one of the areas that that you've learned quite a bit is on the investment side. I mean, whether that is as an angel investor in Cornerstone or later on, you know, becoming an LP and part of the Mountain Nazca, a VC firm there in Mexico. I guess from the investment side of things, how did you get into investing in startups? And then also, based on your experience investing in startups and with a company like Cornerstone that experienced crazy growth, what are some of the patterns that you've seen from companies that make something incredible happen compared to those that maybe fail in the journey of trying to do so?
Oh, that's an amazing... Actually, that's the first time I hear this question, you know, structured like that. So I think the most common thing that I see in successful founders, it's how they relate to each other or how they complement to each other. So for example, in Cornershop, let's say Cornershop, like they have three amazing founders, you know, all of them engineers, two of them, you know, doing code or very expert, you know, highly expertise on coding. And the other one, like, you know, it was like another kind of engineer, but with a perfect sense of storytelling and leadership. Like Oscar, it's one of the best CEOs I've ever seen in my life. And the other two are perfect, like for technology and operations. You know, they're humble. They are very keen to solve everything with technology, very people driven and very culture driven and very efficiency driven as well. So, you know, this combination of founders that has their egos aside and they can have very difficult conversations, and letting one of them taking decisions on their own, you know, teams and everything, creates this, you know, trust space where you can actually execute, you know, because you are trusting your co-founder, you are trusting the other person that will execute in the way they need to be executing. And you can focus 100% on the tasks and milestones that you need to bring to the table so you can have a very complementary skill set so you can succeed. That's the most common thing I see on teams, you know? That there are, of course, very talented solo founders, which is not a path that I would be willing to go through, because I need to go to war, you know, shoulder by shoulder with someone, you know, because it's more, I don't know, probably I'm a CC, I don't know. Probably I'm afraid to go alone, but I've seen solo founders that are amazing, but I think most successful companies are with, you know, these kind of founders. Complementary founders.
What about on that mastering numbers? What is so important about mastering numbers, which is another thing that I know that that you experience?
So for me, I'm a very obsessed person with numbers. I love numbers. I love crunching numbers and analyzing numbers, because even though that, you know, the first draft of a business model or a financial model that you create 99% sure that it's not gonna be and that it's not gonna end up like that, right? But the way you create those assumptions in order for you to have a result for the future, for me, it's very important. And if I see a founder that doesn't have this like reliable walkthrough, or they can walk me through the numbers or assumptions in a very simple and clear way to see their outcomes for the next, probably not the 5 years, not 10 years, but probably the next 2 years, the first year, I feel a little bit cautious. I feel a little bit uncomfortable of someone that doesn't know their numbers. Probably they can sell me the vision and how they can rule the world or whatever they are trying to accomplish. But if they don't have these, you know, clear visibility on how they are getting to those numbers, even though that they're going to complete lie in the future, I need to see that. And successful founders know every single one of their numbers. Even in you know, in Series A or Series B founders, if they, I'm a founder that knows exactly how much revenue we made since day one, every single year. And we are 6 years in now. So I know exactly how much revenue, gross margins have. The main KPIs, I know exactly by memory, every single one of them. And if I see in my investment role, if I don't see a founder that knows exactly all their numbers, I feel cautious.
Now, how do you go from, you know, experiencing the investment side, you know, being able to see such amazing stories like a Corner Shop and also, you know, like seeing other companies with Nazca, to then going at it again, you know, as an entrepreneur, obviously now, you know, with what you got going on, which we're going to be talking about it, you know, with Fairplay, but before that, you know, with Pulpomatic, I mean, it's quite interesting, you know, that you took a segue, you know, and a 180, you know, and said, no, I'm just going to be a founder.
Yes. So it was like, as you mentioned, like first I was a founder very early on in my career, then corporate guy, then entrepreneurship, then entrepreneur, VC entrepreneur again. So that gave me an edge. I think it gave me an edge because with Nazca, I learned, you know, the dynamics of how, you know, investors and founders operate. The dynamics between, you know, in the boards, the board meetings, between with other investors as well, the different personalities of founders. Like, I think that helped me and that raised me, if I can say it like that, in a very different way. Nazca helped me understanding that venture capital, it's all about the capabilities of the founders and the vision of the founders and how you can support to that. And the dynamics of that we venture capitalists are not your boss, we are your partner. So I understood that. And I'm seeing, like, now as a founder, I see a lot of venture firms thinking about the dynamics in a very different way than I see it. So I learned that in Nazca. I think it was the best school I could ever imagine. And I'm very grateful with them, with Hector and with the team. And I think that helped shape my career in a different way.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of cycle. So, again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to Z all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So then let's talk about going at it again, you know, as a founder. You know, talk to us about, again, you know, doing the switch from investor to founder once again.
So the story was very, very funny. I was a COO for Nazca. And then the way we started to think about like new deal flow, it was like, okay, so there are a lot of founders bringing a lot of different business models that are not for our thesis. How about if we design the business model and then go out and look for a couple of founders that could, you know, execute on this idea, and we give them the resources to do that. Not as a company builder, but with the idea and $1 million as a seed round, right? That way we made sure that we would be investing in our thesis, exactly in our thesis. So that worked, and the first business model that we started to evaluate or to think about, it was revenue-based financing for e-commerce companies. And we got in love with that business model. We designed the first financials and the first business model and everything, Hector and myself. And then when we said, okay, let's go out and look for a founder that could execute this, we looked for Andrew, my co-founder. And he said like, yeah, I'm all in. I really understand this business model. I really liked it. I want to work with you guys as investors. And then a few days later, I talked to Andrew because Andrew and I know each other since we were like 11 years old. So was Hector with Nazca. Like the three of us know each other since we were like kids. And I told Andrew, hey man, probably I would be willing to jump out of Nazca. And, you know, if you are willing to do that with me as co-founders, that would be amazing. And he's like, of course. And then we talked to Hector and he was like, hey, even better, you know, who better to do this than you, that you designed all these business models. And the rest is history. We started in 2019 as Fairplay, you know, doing our first deals.
So for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of Fairplay? How are you guys making money?
So basically, we started as revenue-based financing for direct-to-consumer companies in the e-commerce world, just investing, like giving them working capital for their marketing campaigns, and just that. And it was like very super niche. And then we started to see that it was not enough. Like if you spend X amount of money in marketing campaigns and you don't have the inventory necessary to sell more, makes no sense. So we started to give them working capital for inventory, then logistics. And then we expanded the model to marketplace sellers like, you know, Mercado Libre and Amazon sellers or Walmart sellers. And then we started to see, okay, retail is way bigger market than e-commerce. And actually, e-commerce is just a channel of retail. So then we expand to retail in general. And then suddenly, 5 years in, we were, you know, servicing SMEs in Mexico. So we started from very niche financial product to a more broad kind of market industry. And now we are giving like technology, and of course, our core lending products for SMEs in Mexico. We are 89 people team now, full-time employees. We originated more than $340 million so far. And like probably 80% of that, we made that in just 2023 and 2024. We are a $12 million revenue company. So we're in the process of scaling and growth stage.
That's amazing. And one thing that probably, you know, would make a difference for folks that are listening is this was an industry that you had no idea about, you know, prior to it. And it was an industry that you just grabbed by the horn. So I guess especially for the people listening, you know, how do you go about approaching an industry that you have no idea about?
Man, that's an amazing question because and that's very important. In our experience throughout the life of Fairplay, that has been key. because you have two ways of doing it. Like, you can go all in naive to one industry, and that's actually a good thing. If you go in very naively, I don't know if that's a word, naively.
Yeah, we all understand. We all understand. Exactly. I also speak Spanglish very well.
I know, exactly. I think everyone understood that, my bad English. But if you go naive, in naive mode, I think that approach helps you a lot because you are not going to have all these, you're not going to have all these bad examples from that industry. You know, you're not going to have all these constraints and bad behaviors of the industry. You're coming new with a clear mind of how to do things. The other thing is, like, if you come arrogant and you say, like, oh, I can disrupt this entire industry by myself. In our case, I'm gonna, you know, get rid of banks and I get rid of financial institutions and regulators. You are doing very, very, very wrong, because the market, you know, in the banking system has been working very well for the last, I don't know, 300, 400 years now. As we know the banking system, probably as we know it, 200 years. So you need to be humble. You know, these guys know what they're doing. So if you're trying to fight with that industry, probably they're going to hit you very, very, very hard. And actually, we receive our couple of hits. You know, we didn't know back then about FX, how to hedge, you know, US dollar-based debt facilities. We didn't know how to strategically, you know, measure the borrowing base and everything. Now you have tools to do that, like VAS and, you know, other things. But back then, we were humble enough to not be killed by the industry. We were in some sense, a little bit arrogant in the way that, oh, we can accomplish whatever we want. And we have a couple of hits in the FX, but we were, like, naive enough in order for us to create a product that the SMEs need. So that combination makes what we have now. But if you are 100% naive, you're stupid. If you are 100% arrogant, you're stupid as well. So you need to combine that.
So obviously, as part of this operation, you got the equity and you got the debt as well. Equity, you know, you raise money, you know, for the operation itself. I mean, for you guys to build the business itself. And then the debt, you know, more for the operational side of things. So walk us through what has been the journey. I mean, one, you know, how much capital have you guys raised on both? And then also, what has been the journey of raising both, and what is the difference from one another?
That's amazing. Actually, that's a very funny question that you ask right now, because I have a story about that. So we have raised, we raised a $5 million seed round back in 2019 before the hype, with just, you know, a PowerPoint. Thank you to QED and Nazca, of course, to push us forward. And then we raised a Series A back in 2021, 13 million Series A, led by Dila Capital, with the participation of Kayak and Kayak Ventures from Chile, Elevar Equity from India, well, India and Latin America, and Speed Invest from Austria. And of course, with the participation of QED and Nazca as well, the follow on. And then we raised like 11, 12 more million, you know, with internal investors. That's on the equity side. And in the debt side, we raised a $20 million facility from Architect Capital based in San Francisco with James Sagan. Awesome, awesome guy. He's a cowboy like Andrew and myself. You know, he was one of the first people giving, you know, credit in Latin America, being a US-based fund. He was one of the first doing that. And then we refinanced that facility with a $100 million facility from CIM, based in San Francisco and New York as well. And then we refinanced that line of credit with BBVA Spark in Mexico with local currency in order for us to, you know, get rid of the hedging nightmare that we had in 2023 and 2024. So now we have we are partners with Spark, BBVA Spark, and that's on the debt side. So answering your question on how to raise equity and how to raise debt, it's a totally different story. Going back to the storytelling, I'm going to tell you a story. And I really hope that these guys listen to this down the road, because it was very, very funny. I was pitching to a German development bank. you know, super serious people, very, very nice people, but very serious. It was like, I don't know, probably six people in the call on their side. I was alone on my side. And for some reason, I just understood back then that they were the debt team on the bank side. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna pitch the risk thing and how I mitigate risk. And it's like the most boring thing to pitch, you know, how you mitigate risk and how you do the underwriting and how you extract the data and how you collect and how you, you know, the legal stuff of the things and how you create the trust, you know, the structure of the trust and everything. So it was extremely boring. And then someone said, or I said something about like the NDA, and they said like, usually we never, you know, sign NDAs for these kind of deals. They were the equity guys inside the bank. And then I asked like, hey, guys, sorry. I'm very, very sorry. I understood that you were the debt team. And they were, no. We invest in growth stage, you know, equity in companies, in fintech, in emerging markets. And I was like, holy shit. Sorry, guys. Can you give me 7 minutes to pitch you accurately on the equity side? And they all laugh and they say like, okay, go ahead. You have your 7 minutes. And then my personality and my narrative and everything changed in a minute. And then I started to pitch the future, the vision, you know, the fun parts of the business. And they were excited. And till now, they potentially are going to participate in one of our rounds, hopefully. But they got in love with the vision and with the business model and with everything just because I changed the narrative and the storytelling behind either if it was debt or equity. So it's a totally different story.
So let's double click on that, on the vision that you were talking about. Imagine you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Fair Play is fully realized. What does that world look like?
Okay, fully realized, we become the financial institution that partnered with the SMEs in Mexico. So we are the main financial institution that serve SMEs very, very deeply with several different financial products and we solve different financial problems to SMEs. We want to do that for the future. That's what we are doing now, and we want that to realize in the future.
Beautiful. Now, let's talk about the past, but doing so with a lens of reflection. Let's say I bring you back in time. I bring you back a few years, and we're not going to date ourselves here, but let's say I bring you back to the time that you were 21 years old, and that moment where you were thinking about maybe launching something of your own. And let's say you have now the opportunity of having a sit down with that younger Manolo and being able to give that Manolo a piece of advice for launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Wow. For starters, I would say that the first sentence that I would, you know, that would come out of my mouth would be, don't be reckless. Because I was reckless. I was irresponsible at that moment. You know, I didn't like took my life seriously. I would say that, like, take your life and your career more seriously. You know, I didn't do that. And I regret that throughout my life. But I think that would be the first advice. And the second one, it's very early to partner with people that it's way much smarter than you.
I love that.
That would be two pieces of advice that I would give the 21-year-old Manolo.
Yeah. I love that. Well, Manolo, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Don't do it, man. I have a lot of work to do. Please don't. No. I always say that as a joke, but jokes aside, actually, I don't know why my phone number leaked on a database or whatever. And I received tons of calls, like, you know, to pitch several things. And I received tons of messages on the LinkedIn inbox. And, you know, I'm trying to work, and I'm going to be more than happy to help other entrepreneurs younger than me or older, I don't care, to walk through this entrepreneurship life. But if I receive a warm intro from a VC fund or from other founder, whatever, it's way easier. In order for me to know exactly what you want, how can I be helpful? And if you are extremely clear with me on what I can be helpful with, for me, it's going to be way better. So if you can ask for an introduction or whatever, that would be way perfect, way better for me. If you, you know, send me a message called in LinkedIn, probably I would never answer back. I'm so sorry about that.
Being intentional. Obviously, you know, for the people that are listening, just make sure you don't mention the database if you decide to call directly.
Exactly. Please don't.
I love it. I love it. Well, hey, Manolo, it's been such an honor to have you with us. Thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show with us today.
Man, my pleasure. Actually, I've been a follower of your podcast and you specifically for years now. And I admire what you're doing. And thank you very much. It's an honor for me to be here. And thank you.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.